Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here when you could be at Jericho Beach. Such a beautiful day. Wonderful days we've been having. You know, I find it very interesting that the Buddha said, even when we're happy, often there's a seed of discontent. You know, here we have these beautiful days, and yet, isn't there the worry about, is there going to be enough rain? We're going to run out of water? I guess that's, you know, just the way we are. Anyway, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about becoming invisible, and then becoming visible. Because several weeks ago, I was reading The New Yorker, a book review in there, and it was a review on a book about invisibility and our attraction, even fascination with invisibility, particularly in popular culture. And reading that brought back a memory many years ago when I was a young lad, about faking an illness one day so I could stay home from school and watch, I think it was in grade 4 or grade 5, and I wanted to watch a show, because in those days, of course, there were no VCRs or anything else, and in Calgary there were two channels. And for some reason, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a show called Carousel, which showed movies. And I saw on the newspaper that the 1933 film Invisible Man was showing. And I was desperate to see it. I had read the classic comic version before. Does everyone know what a classic comic is? based on H.G. Wells' famous book, of course, his novel. At any rate, I had read that several years before, and it both spooked me and really intrigued me, and I so wanted to see the movie, because I thought, what a great superpower it would be to be able to come invisible. It'd be so cool. Unfortunately, for the invisible man, the invisibility drove him insane and ultimately led to his death. But I thought, surely one could be more careful with this power. And indeed, a more careful use of this superpower is told in the Harry Potter books when he discovers and wears his famous cloak of invisibility. It helps them in all kinds of tricky situations. But then again, there's Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the long tale of the One Ring that makes the wearer invisible and gradually bends the wearer, though, towards darkness. And even the very kind and morally upright Frodo began to give in to unwholesome desires at the end under its influence. Still, despite the dangers, haven't we all wished for that power at some point? In junior high school, I was very curious about the girls' locker room, wondering how it's different from the boys. But I never, ever got up the courage to peek in, even when there was no one else around, when I was at school at night for some kind of special event. Perhaps if I had had Harry Potter's cloak, I would have dared. And this, even beyond those kind of pop culture aspects of invisibility, there's a long history of fascination with becoming invisible. Plato wrote in the Republic about the ring of Gyges, a cautionary tale about invisibility and immorality. Gyges was, for those of you who may not remember your high school Greek mythology, I think he was a shepherd who discovered a ring that made him invisible. And then he arranged to be chosen as one of the shepherds who would appear before the king to talk about the status of the flocks, the sheep at that time. And then arriving at the palace, he used this new power of invisibility to seduce the queen. And I'm not quite sure how that worked, but anyway. And then with her help, he murdered the king and became king himself. Apparently, invisibility brings out the worst in us. So perhaps it's a good thing I had no cloak as a junior high school student. Who knows what would have happened? As I was writing this, I thought, you know, even being invisible wouldn't have helped me about my curiosity about seeing the inside of the girls' change rooms. Because, if I have this correctly, I would also be blind. If I was invisible, I would be blind. Now, you can check my biology about this, but light would pass through me, being invisible, and not register on my retina at all. So no signals from light would ever get to my brain. Does that make sense? In other words, the way we can see things is because light hits and stimulates our retina in some way, and then we get those electrical impulses. So I think this is something that H.G. Wells and J.K. Rowling and perhaps Plato never considered. And yet, despite the possibility of blindness, there have been a number of times I have tried to become invisible, and with varying degrees of success. Mostly when I wanted to get away from something like an embarrassing situation, or when I was about to be called upon in class in some way that I hadn't prepared for. Anyway, you know, the typical kind of unpleasant situations. And perhaps most of us who are shy or introverted by nature have a particular interest in invisibility. But surely most of us have wished for this power at one time or another. And when we cannot become completely invisible, we make do with partial invisibility. For example, you know, careful use of clothes, makeup, hair pieces, cosmetic surgery, room lighting. At least we can hide a part of ourselves. That's not acceptable. In other words, we hide. We use these things to hide rather than to adorn or to, you know, make ourselves beautiful in some way. The intention is to cover up, to disappear. So much stress in our society is placed on what is visible, the appearance of things. So we strive to disappear the blemishes of the body, personality, or past actions. Whatever it is, we don't want to be seen. I speculate, you know, one reason that we have this fantasy of complete invisibility is because we're already halfway there. We make large parts of ourselves invisible. Those parts that go beyond the physical, even. In Japan, there are two terms that define key values of Japanese society. There's tatemai and honne. And tatemai, we are actions or language that's expected by society and necessary according to one's position and circumstances. Whether those actions and our speech really agrees with what's going on inside. And honne, on the other hand, is one's true thoughts and feelings, which may be really contrary to what's required by circumstances. And these thoughts and feelings are often kept hidden and unexpressed. So while this tatemai and honne are accepted cultural values in Japan, don't they really also apply to much of our life here? And just as in Japan, we too use tatemai and honne to protect ourselves. We use it as a social lubricant, helping our interactions go smoothly. Sometimes it's really necessary, right? Not to speak exactly what you think. And then there are times when what comes out of our mouths surprises even us. The Chinese Zen master Nanchuan said, when you know something, you are deluded. When you know something, you are deluded. And when I consider what I know best, surely it's me. I know myself best. My feelings, perceptions, thinking, sensations, body, this I know. At least I think I know. Because I consider this my firm and stable footing in the world. This is who I am. And most of us have a pretty good idea, a pretty strong sense of who we are. But have you ever noticed at times you don't know? Something happens. Perhaps you have experienced a kind of disquiet or surprise at what you just did or what you just said. What did I just say? Why did I do that? As if it were a different person who said that or who did that. Someone else acted, and not you. During a simple conversation with somebody, we might speak an opinion or view that really comes from something we've heard or read, and it's not really our own. We exaggerate or downplay at times to fit in, to answer what is called for rather than what is true or real. Honne tatemai. When I say I think, it is at times not me who thinks, but something else speaking through my mouth. It is a desire to be liked, accepted, to fit in, to be special, or a fear, maybe. A fear at being contrary, bothersome, different. And in doing so, sometimes in using this tatemai, we have come to habitually present ourselves rather than be ourselves. Stuff gets added and stuff gets hidden. Stuff gets hidden. there is, I think, a general assumption that what is invisible, what is hidden, if made visible, will cause suffering and distress. And that's one reason, maybe the main reason, why we make it invisible in the first place. And, of course, in some circumstances, that's true. But we become deluded about the nature and scope of the unseen, of the invisible. Entranced by the seen, we become oblivious to what we don't see, to what is not completely clear in front of us. The Buddhist tradition, our Zen practice, is about awakening from this kind of entrancement. And I believe it is about making the invisible visible. Making the invisible visible means to understand in our very bones the illusory or the ephemeral nature of appearance and become aware of what is invisible, intimate, and boundless. Just as the outside world is vastly more than what we see, our nature is much more than our thoughts, feelings, perceptions that's encased in this skin bag, as the old Zen masters like to call this body. We all learned, right, in high school classes, in those science classes on warm afternoons, that the world is not as it appears. It is mysterious, filled with unnoticed forces, so that even seemingly solid objects are in fact mostly space, filled with bits of concentrated energy whizzing around at tremendous speeds. Here are a few words written by Catherine Schultz, who wrote that book review I mentioned at the very beginning about invisibility and talking about the unseen of the world. And she writes, "Almost everything around us is imperceptible. Almost all the rest is maddeningly difficult to perceive, and what remains scarcely amounts to anything. Physicists estimate that less than 5% of the known universe is visible. Less than 5% is visible. Where visible means only that we could theoretically observe it, given the right instruments and sufficient physical proximity. A far smaller amount of the known universe, approximately 0.3%, is dense enough to form stars. 0.3% is dense enough to form stars. Perhaps 0.000001% exists in Earth-like planets. As for the part that exists in or near our own planet, the stuff that is visible to us in any literal sense, that is a decimal attenuating out to almost nothing. A speck of dust in the cosmic hinterlands. An invisible mass alters the orbit of a comet. Dark energy affects acceleration of a supernova. The Earth's magnetic field tugs on birds, butterflies, sea turtles, and the compasses of mariners. The whole realm of the visible is compelled by the invisible. Our planet, our solar system, our galaxy, our universe, all of it, all of us, are pushed, pulled, spun, shifted, set in motion, and held together by what we cannot see. Our practice, and maybe this is true of all religious practices, is really to question and explore our life. Some begin by exploring with a feeling that reality of the workaday world and the kind of limitedness that we feel is not quite right. Something seems wrong about it. For others, it's dukkha, or dissatisfaction, the first noble truth of the Buddha that begins our journey. We try so hard to be good, to be well-liked, to not hurt others or hurt ourselves. We try so hard to become better, happier, more worthy. We all want affirmation. We all want to take our place in the world, and yet we keep falling down. Our efforts are sincere, our intentions are wholesome, but something isn't quite right. I tried this, I tried that, and still something seems to be missing. I still keep bumping into walls. I still feel incomplete, still keep hurting others and myself. Acknowledging our usual ways of dealing with our suffering, with our dukkha, we acknowledge those don't seem to really work very long or very well. So having come through this struggle, one way or another, and maybe that makes us ready to take on what we have tried to avoid all along. We begin to turn to what we have hidden, to what is invisible, to what we have made invisible. In Dogen Zenji's language, we shine the light of our awareness inward, and we begin to illuminate the self, the unseen self. Anyone who has taken up the practice of meditation for a while knows that this is not easy. Because sooner or later, we become face to face with those parts of ourselves we have tried so long not to see. We come face to face with our darkness, our yuckiness. And here is the first challenge of practice. To stay with that darkness with a kind of gentle courage. Using the tools our teachers and ancestors have provided to us to make fully visible what we have so long hidden. The fundamental practice is simply not to move, not to turn away. Just as it helps to keep the body quite still when we meditate, so we keep our mind and our heart still by not entering into a story about what it means, about what should have happened, about how we have failed or how we have succeeded. This is the practice of illumination, where the attention is focused and held in place by bringing a kind of sense of curiosity to bear. What is this? Where is it felt? Without grasping or trying to do anything. Without grasping or trying to do anything. We release ourselves to our own life. And at that moment, We trust that our lives are all that we need. So in doing this, what becomes visible? Well, the background and the context of our particular life, of your particular life, as part of the vast world, becomes clearer. And with that, we come to deeply realize that we are not alone in our unhappily poignant situation, whatever that is. We are not alone. The separateness, so long kind of clung onto as part of our story, is just part of the story that makes invisible the truth that we are intimately bound together. So we begin to see and understand our nature differently. But maybe this is not a new understanding. Maybe this is not a new view of our life and the world, but rather our original view. The one we had a long time ago. Apparently, children up to the age of 4 become invisible by simply closing or covering their eyes. You ever played peekaboo? One researcher at the University of Cambridge recently gathered a group of children together and had them wear one of those sleeping masks, covering their eyes. So when their eyes were covered, they were then asked whether they could be seen by the researchers. With most of the children, of course, saying, "No, you can't see me." Quite charming. The researchers then attempted to distinguish what exactly creates that feeling of invisibility when we cover our eyes, or when children cover their eyes. Whether it's not being able to see at all, or just because the other person couldn't see their eyes. And this is what's interesting. When the children were asked to explain how they were made invisible by simply covering or hiding their eyes, many knew their bodies remained visible. The same ones that had said they're invisible, but they knew their bodies remained visible. It seems that a child does not suppose you cannot see her arms or legs, head or feet, but that she cannot be seen. In other words, I'm speculating a little bit here. In other words, she is distinct from the body. Unlike our common view that, you know, kind of myself, that I am largely, you know, this body, for a child it seems the self is not located in the body. For a child, it seems the self is not located in the body. That sense of self and the body as one, as being kind of a single unit, comes later. Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, the kind of view that Zen and other traditions, Buddhist traditions that come out of the Mahayana stream, discusses the paradox of reality as having two aspects. The the relative and the absolute. The relative and the absolute. And for us, in our everyday life, so involved in the relative aspect of our lives, the absolute remains unseen most of the time. It remains invisible. And maybe we experience from time to time kind of intimations of something larger than ourselves. But usually we're too busy or we're too prejudiced to really notice the vastness of our lives. That vastness remains unseen, invisible. Just as Catherine Schutz wrote about the vastness of the outer unseen, the vastness of this universe that we don't see, perhaps the same is true of the inner unseen, our inner invisibility. Remember, Catherine wrote, "Our planet, our solar system, our galaxy, our universe, all of it, all of us, are pushed, pulled, spun, set in motion, and held together by what we cannot see." What is the scope of our inner unseen nature? We each have to make that journey ourselves to really know. But let me end with a few quotes from one of my favorite Chinese Zen ancestors, Hongzhi, who uses the image of an empty field as a kind of poetic metaphor to describe his own experience. So this is what Hongzhi wrote. "The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same cool, this field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. We all have the clear, wondrously bright field from the beginning." In his writings, Hongzhi encourages all to practice, both in meditation, but also in our everyday lives, bringing forth this field of boundless emptiness. Our life, as Hongzhi describes it, is vast and spacious. But to see this clearly, we practice. We make the invisible visible. And fortunately, brothers and sisters in the Dharma, we don't practice alone. Well, thank you for listening. And I look forward to making the invisible visible with you all for the next little while.